Welcome to The Edge. I'm your host, Tom Smith. Our guest today is Rex Curry, a Tampa-based libertarian attorney who specializes in constitutional law and criminal defense. Welcome to The Edge, Rex.
Hey, thanks, Tom, for having me on.
We're going to have discuss a number of topics today, ranging from local election to a number of things going on around the country. And Rex, I'm going to let you start the game.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tom. What bothered me lately, being here on HawkNet, is the Virginia Tech shootings. Mass slaughter. And it was caused by disarmament zones. The government disarms citizens, and especially so in colleges and universities, and that's what happened up there. It leaves the students defenseless. So it's an important topic for students everywhere, including here, and it could happen again because nothing's changed. In fact, the government seems to be even more interested in disarming people as opposed to giving people their Second Amendment rights, the right to self-defense, the right to stop mass slaughters that occur like that one, either on a campus or a college or mm-hmm. anywhere mm-hmm. or outside. And the problem with the situation right now is even ridiculous in some ways because there are colleges that teach future law enforcement officers specifically for that purpose mm-hmm. to become deputies and police officers. And these people who are in the process of becoming gun-toting law enforcement officers are not able to carry guns while they're supposed to be learning how to carry guns. I don't know if you've seen them, but they carry plastic guns
yeah.
in their holsters.
Yeah, right here.
And so that would be quite odd, too, if some horrible tragedy happened. We would have college classrooms full of people with future law enforcement officers packing plastic guns and holsters, and they would be in the same boat as all the other students who have yeah. been disarmed by the government. And ironically, the thing that happened, as it did in the Virginia Tech situation, is after the lunatic is killed, he actually killed himself,
yeah.
and he did it with a gun, the government completely reverses its course, rushes people with guns to the scene.
Yeah.
Of course, it's already too late. They've
yeah.
already disarmed everybody. Everybody's dead, including the gunman who killed himself. It's a tragedy, and it could happen again. Everybody is a sitting duck mm-hmm. because of the politicians and the government policies of disarming people. I don't understand it. Do you understand it? I have no idea.
Well, I know that about a year prior to that shooting, there was legislation that went through the Virginia Assembly, and it was voted down, and there was I recall reading in the Roanoke newspaper, there was a article, and there was two people who were quoted in it. They both worked for Virginia Tech, and they were lauding how this bill was defeated. They thought it was just great that and now our campuses are going to be safe because people can't bring guns on there. And how ironic that just a little over a year later, there's this tragic mass murder by a lunatic. And another thing I want to say is that there are certain pundits in the media who want to position. In fact, the whole brunt of the media approach had been to talk about the weapon that was used and to talk about the grief and the aftermath. That was their focus. It wasn't on how did this guy come about, what were the warning signs. This guy had exhibited antisocial behavior psychopathic behavior for quite some time before that.
One reason why they probably don't want to talk about it is because we can blame them for the murders. That mentality, not only the media mentality, but the actual politicians who you just referenced, who, as you described, it's a World Net Daily article from April 16. It says a college spokesman celebrated the 2006 defeat of a bill that would have allowed handguns on campuses because it would, according to him, help make campus safe.
Yeah.
And, of course, it did the complete opposite. It's an interesting philosophical question. Should people actually be held liable as murderers, aiding and abetting murder, co-conspirators in a murder, politicians who disarm students, young people, the prime of their lives, and then enable them to be killed, defenseless, begging for their lives, but essentially waiting their turn to be shot?
It certainly, to me, looks like it is plausible that they're accessories prior to the fact. And I think that should be looked at. Mm-hmm. I think that's definitely a viable legal angle to take a look at.
Also, in Utah, you made me think of, I'm looking at a KSL News blurb. It says, Utah is the only state that prohibits public colleges and universities from banning concealed weapons on campus. Nationwide, 38 states and the District of Columbia prohibit concealed weapons at schools. Of those, 16 explicitly ban concealed weapons at colleges and universities, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. In other states, colleges are allowed to formulate their own gun policies. So apparently, Utah is the only place that actively prevents these crazy murderous politicians from disarming the victims and creating victim disarmament zones, and which result in mass slaughters.
Yeah.
Also, the weird thing is here in Florida, which is one of those states that prohibits, or I don't even want to say prohibits, that creates victim disarmament zones that disarm the victims on college campuses and other schools, is they step up. Not very recently, there have been a couple of arrests of people on college campuses or schools who simply for possessing guns inside their cars.
Mm-hmm.
One of them happened in Tampa, Florida, and another one happened in Orlando. Nothing happened. There was no allegation of violence or threats or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, here in Florida, there are other laws that enable people to carry guns concealed in their vehicles securely encased. That you can do that routinely without even having a permit for personal possession.
That's right.
Okay. So this is a very interesting question. Since one of them's local, I actually thought about perhaps volunteering to challenge that. I hope whoever does represent this person does make a challenge to it, because depending on how you interpret this law, it is being violated constantly, all the time, by parents dropping their kids off at schools, by people driving through the roads that go through the University of South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if the police decided to start doing roadblock type searches or even consent searches. Not only do most of the people involved not know how the government and its police state mentality might be reinterpreting these laws, but you could imagine them going to schools and arresting parents all over the place,
mm-hmm.
in front of their children,
mm-hmm.
for actually trying to defend themselves, for actually having the ability to stop a Virginia Tech-type massacre.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the government will do the opposite and attempt to make it even worse by going around arresting people for trying to exercise their their Second Amendment rights or constitutional rights under the Bill of Rights.
Very good point, Rex. And for those who are interested in what it takes, I mean, how people wonder how this Cho fellow got to the point where he had the mentality of a murderer, and there was a series of stages. I recommend our listeners take a look at, it's a book called Why They Kill, written by Richard Rhodes, and it's based on the research of the criminologist Lonnie Athens. And you can actually, if you do a web search there, you can actually get a page. There's a few sample pages from that book. One of them actually has the information there kind of in a condensed form of the series of steps it takes to bring a person to the point where they have the mentality of a murderer. And these steps so happen to be pretty common in low-income areas and in prisons. And so this the fact of somebody using a weapon like a gun or a knife or something to murder someone, it isn't the gun or the knife that has any causative factor at all. There are certain events that have to occur, certain cultural factors that have to be in place. It's not something which, despite the appearance our media, the popular media is trying to create, it has nothing to do with an object and everything to do with social factors.
Yeah, so think about the students and everyone out there. Your government, politicians have turned you into sitting ducks. Nothing's changed. In fact, it's actually getting worse. They're becoming more police state about disarming people. And you're sitting in class. You can just imagine what would happen. What, the same thing at Virginia Tech. Wait your turn to be shot because you have been deprived of any other means of doing anything. The cultural factors you mentioned, Tom, fascinating stuff because it part of that culture led to what's known as the socialist Holocaust, of which the Holocaust was a part, the worst mass slaughters in all of history. Some put it at 60 million people slaughtered under the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, 50 million under the People's Republic of China, 20 million under the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Not only were those also cultures of poverty, because socialism creates massive poverty, but that the attitude, the cultural attitude of squashing individual rights.
Yeah.
The rights we're supposed to have under the Bill of Rights. Yeah. And the Bill of Rights, of course, is not about hunting. It's about protecting yourself from these crazy politicians, from the government, from the Holocaust and the Holocaust and the mass slaughter that comes from that mentality of murder, a murderous type of mentality in government that also happens to aid lunatics, the other lunatics, the individual lunatics out on the street when they disarm people. So one reason why we're all disarmed is also because not only are they passing laws to disarm the victims, but they're also passing other laws that they think are important. Their time spent like putting a flag in every classroom, which they even do in colleges. Now, on the lower levels, not only do they have these flags, but they make children chant to them every morning robotically for 12 years of their lives. And that was written by Francis Bellamy, a well-known socialist in the United States of America in 1892. And a lot of people don't know this, but I'm the person who exposed it as the origin of the stiff-arm salute of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, which also pursued a disarmament policy in order to aid it in slaughtering so many millions of people. So the original salute, the early salute of the Pledge of Allegiance in the USA, was a stiff-arm salute. It was a military salute that was then extended out towards the flag. And to this day, although they have changed the gesture, they changed it because of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, they're still doing the same robotic chanting, the glorification of government, and requiring it by law. We actually have a law in Florida that makes teachers go through the ritual every morning for 12 years of every child's life, even though children can, if they were told, which they aren't, they can refuse. They can refuse to participate. Fortunately, they don't try to make us do it here on a campus, or they don't make college students do it. I imagine it would be, that would be even wild, or I doubt many people do it, other than I guess the people who really are into socialism and government worship.
So that really is, there's actually a statute here in Florida that they have to do it in the grades kindergarten through 12th grade. They have to actually have a pledge.
Yes, and and they do it too. It's in fact they've basically automated it. They pipe it into the speakers. They even have TVs in the classrooms, and they push in a video cassette or DVD that plays this weird patriotic intro with somebody doing it, and everybody is invited to stand. And you know, a lot of our politicians have done a lot to encourage students not to do the pledge anymore. For example, the current president, George W. Bush, he's probably massively increased the number of students who do not do the Pledge of Allegiance anymore. Yeah. One of our local senators, Senator Mike Fasano, has passed and supported odd legislation that's related to this. One of his was larger flags. He wanted larger flags in classrooms. So a lot of the schools were unhappy because it just meant they had to spend a lot of money trying to make their flags a little bit bigger. But one of the reasons why you don't see flags on poles, even here at HCC, is and the reason that they're basically hanging on a nail mm-hmm. by a yellow cord mm-hmm. is because that was one of the ways that they circumvented or minimized Senator Mike Fasano's idiotic legislation. They didn't have to spend money getting wooden poles and attaching the flag and sticking metal clasps screwed in with drills into the walls. All they had to do, what they did, was they ordered a bunch of larger flags with ropes, and you can go into any room and find something you can hang it on. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's hanging flat up against the wall. It's because of this silly law that one of our local legislators was passing, who I don't think he's proposed repealing any laws that now disarm people and prevent them from defending themselves, exercising their Second Amendment rights, the mm-hmm. Bill of Rights. He may be too busy passing bigger flag laws so the kids can robotically chant the government instead. Yeah.
What if a student doesn't want to even listen to that stuff?
That's a good question. There's been some famous cases. In fact, the odd thing was a lot of the cases happened at the same time it was happening under the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Kids were being persecuted here and there for the same gesture for refusing to do it. And it went all the way to U.S. Supreme Court. Originally they lost, but eventually they won. But some things have not actually been answered by the U.S. Supreme Court, although they're sometimes answered by other courts, which is, can you leave the room if you don't even want to watch it? Can you just sit down and not even stand up? Some schools and some politicians try to convince students that they have to stand even though they don't gesture or chant. Other questions arise as to, what about the teachers? There hasn't actually been a U.S. Supreme Court case that I'm aware of. What if the teacher doesn't want to do it? They're required by law to lead it, to participate, which is, I mean, in a sense, that's even worse. They're supposed to try to lead all these poor little children in this bizarre old socialist ritual that still hangs around. And that hasn't really been litigated. And of course, the teachers, I'm sure, they're very concerned about losing their jobs. They don't want to find out whether they're going to succeed in refusing to participate. So, but they probably express their views in other ways in classrooms. You know, I don't know if the students would even notice if they stopped. Some, you know, there's getting to be more and more students who don't do it at all, thanks to the idiotic situation. You know, we were talking about this culture of death, this culture of murder, in the context of the Virginia Tech shootings, and I already mentioned the socialist Holocaust and also the Holocaust. Well, you know, people say, what causes people to do that? Hey, well, the government is in Iraq. They make up lies to justify it. Some of the most bizarre things, even suggesting almost psychopathic personality in that regard. One man died in friendly fire, and they make up bizarre lies, just as you would expect from the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics or the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Same thing with the lady who was rescued from the enemy. She was in a hospital. They made up absurd lies about that. It seems like everything they do involves just bizarre lies. Mm-hmm. And it's all used to justify and to continue to promote the invasion of a country that had nothing to do with 9/11.
That's right.
And the 15 of the 19 people on the planes that crashed on 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And they didn't do anything in that regard. In fact, it seems to be this bizarre lie to distract you from the fact that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11 and that Saudi Arabia did.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. So that might explain why we have these psychopathic personalities and this this culture of mass slaughter, and how it leads to the worst slaughters in all of history.
That's right. Rex, very good points, good observations. I'd actually like to go to the local events here. We had an interesting election locally here in Tampa back in March. There was in District 7 for the city commission. Joe Redner ran in a runoff against Gwen Miller. And Gwen is a rather seasoned politician. Joe is a celebrity of sorts. He is the owner of some adult clubs in Hillsborough County. And the final results of the election were, well, he made a decent showing, 44% of the vote. He did pretty well. He did comment that he, next time around, when he runs again, and he's really dedicated on running for public office again, he's going to focus more on the issues. He sees that as important. He wants people to be aware of those issues, that's really that's why he's running. There was a debate back in March between the two candidates. There was supposed to be a debate at the Tiger Bay Club, which is a political club here in the Tampa Bay area. And curious thing was, Gwen Miller didn't show up. And you'd think the Tiger Bay Club is of some importance. It's not not like a bowling league. It is a very significant, influential political group. And she decided she wasn't going to show up. She didn't want to debate Joe head-on, which is curious. Another curious thing is she raised about $135,000 total. Joe Redner did not solicit any contributions. He got about $1,000 from supporters, compared to, which is less than 1% of what Gwen Miller got from her deep-pocketed political connections. Joe did loan his campaign $50,000. So, well, I have to wish Gwen well for what she did. She does have a support from a significant constituency. There are a lot of people who like her. Joe intends to run for county commission in 2008. And Rex, do you have any, you want to comment?
Oh, yeah, Joe, he's like a folk hero around here. Great to have somebody like that. You can just imagine how boring other cities and counties are all across the USA, because they don't have somebody like Joe Redner, who brings so much happiness to so many people's lives. But really, it's amazing. Yeah. And he's been duking it out with the government for so long, getting, you know, multi-million-dollar verdicts, I understand, from various places, who have tried to harass him and shut him down and stomp on him like most people do all over the USA now, the government.
Yeah.
And all because people want to be left alone and want to exercise their individual rights.
Yeah.
And the girls and the boys, whether it's dancing or entertainment of various types. I think that he's very libertarian in that sense. I didn't get a whole lot of libertarianism from his other positions, but as far as the dancing and entertainment venues, he's really put Tampa on the map, and it's been so much fun to watch for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it occurs to me, we have this enormous stadium, and I said this a long time ago, especially when they were about to pass a new tax to tear down the old stadium and build a new one.
Yeah.
For the socialized football stadium,
yeah,
where the government gets involved in picking what sports they're going to promote and what they want you to watch.
And it's also a perfect example of corporate welfare.
Yeah, it's kind of a violent sport, you know. People actually do get seriously injured, paralyzed, even die historically from it, still do. And not only that, but they have assembly line searches down there. They want... Or they may have stopped that, but they want to have them, and they had them, and they'd like to reinstate them, and I think it's still being litigated. But, the parents would take their kids down there, the same kids that go to the government schools, and teach them how to go through assembly line searches, which were a farcical anyway, but for some strange reason, people think it means something. I guess it's like the Pledge of Allegiance. And I said at the time, why can't we be different? Instead of just being another stupid town that taxes people illegally, involuntarily, steals from people to promote a sport, a particular sport that happens to be popular, football, not popular anywhere else in the world, but in America, other parts of the world that's called soccer, but why not instead do something different? Let's build an enormous stadium for Joe Radnor, and that'll be Tampa's kind. This is the sunshine state, the funshine state, the gunshine state, whatever. let's be different. And the least they could have done was actually made him part of it. He's like right there. Couldn't they give him some of those box seats, create the special level where it'd be like Tampa's new dancing entertainment along with the violent football sport? What a great combination. But of course I oppose all taxation. I think the government shouldn't be involved in football either, as well as not being involved in harassing Joe Radnor. But these are all interesting philosophical points that explain to you and everyone how bad government is, how hypocritical it is, how it steals and promotes particular sports, and at the same time tries to stomp on other people who are not violent people, who are not engaging in assembly line searches, who would like to be left alone, and then those people get to sue the government for lots of money, and which we, of course, also pay for. So my hat's off to Joe Radnor. Hope he stays around a while. It's been a lot of fun watching. Hope it's going to stay fun. Something else we could do besides helping Joe out with multi-million dollar new dancing sport facility would be, how about gun ranges instead of football stadiums?
Hey, that'd be great.
It actually has to do with Second Amendment rights, the Bill of Rights. But, the government doesn't want you to have that, right? They really don't like it. They'd rather you, what do they call them, dog and pony show, circuses, bread and circuses.
Yeah. Yeah.
And keep you distracted with football. And how about, what are schools for anyway? It used to be they had gun clubs and target clubs, and people would bring their guns to schools.
Yeah.
And instead, the government doesn't have any classes. They're not going to have gun classes or even teach you about guns or how to use them, other than maybe if you're actually in some kind of law enforcement gear. And why do they do that, Tom? I have a theory, though. The government does run all the schools pretty much. They monopolize schools all through grade school, 1 through 12. So they know what they think about you already. That's why they have you robotically chant every morning for 12 years of your life. They don't trust you. they're the ones running the school. They already think you're a lame brain, you know? They already don't think that you're capable of being a responsible human being and understanding Second Amendment rights. I mean, that's why they're disarming you. They consider you a danger to them because they're taxing and stealing from you and stomping on you and imposing a police state. So they're not about to help you think about owning and using a gun.
Perhaps their fear is that you might wake up and see what's going on.
Exactly. Exactly. You know what? I'm glad you brought up Joe Redner. He's always a fun person to follow. He almost made it that time. He may eventually make it.
I think so. I think if he plans to start a campaign, to start campaigning now and actually get himself the public, or those people at least in the district, they're aware that where his positions are on various issues related to county government, I think that and does it, you know, runs a consistently, let's say, open campaign, which he does, really gets out and lets people know that where he stands in issues. I think he will prevail in this election. He's learned a lot by running. I think he's run 8 times. He's really learned a lot, got some experience, and he came close in the city of Tampa. And I think he will. I think he'll prevail this time.
I remember some recent litigation. There was an appellate court litigation, oral arguments, and I think a question was raised by one of the people at the appellate court oral argument about the assembly line searches that were going on at Tampa Stadium. The question was something like, well, what's got to happen in order to justify assembly line searches? The person was asking the people who oppose assembly line searches, the people who support the Fourth Amendment, the other amendment, there's like a bunch of them, you know, Bill of Rights. And what's got to happen? Some explosion or terrorist act? And, of course, Tom, we being somewhat libertarian-oriented or more individual rights-oriented, we're more likely to think, yeah, what's got to happen? A Virginia Tech-type slaughter, which would be caused by the assembly line searches? The farces where only the law-abiding citizens go through the victim disarmament zone. I would say to this person who asked that question, you, the person who disarmed those people, whereas the crazy man shows up, has no problem getting in there. The searches are absurd anyway. And then what, everybody gets to stand in line to await being shot as they were in Virginia Tech because your assembly line searches disarmed all the good people? So again, it makes me actually start to think about these concepts of aiding and abetting murderers, co-conspiracies to assist murderers, and how these people cause so much blood on their hands, the hands of government, by how they treat people and their individual rights.
Thank you. We're interviewing right now Rex Curry, who's a Tampa-based libertarian attorney who specializes in constitutional law and criminal defense. And Rex has actually done quite a bit of interesting research on the Pledge of Allegiance. And you can actually go to his website at rexcurry.net, R-E-X-C-U-R-R-Y.net, and see for yourself where the Pledge of Allegiance came from. You'll read about his name. What's his first name? Bellamy?
Francis Bellamy.
Francis Bellamy. Now, he had a brother or a cousin who was also...
Cousin Edward Bellamy, who wrote, at that time, a famous book called Looking Backward. It spawned an international movement called the Nationalism Movement, promoting their socialist philosophy, which they called military socialism. That's why the pledge. That's one reason why he liked starting the pledge with a military salute, which was then extended out towards the flag, and was the origin of the stiff arm salute.
That sounds a whole lot like the type of socialism that went into Nazi Germany, that military socialism.
Oh, yeah. I've just been doing some more writing about the origins of fascist symbolism, and so much of it does or originate, it seems, in the USA. You know, Mussolini didn't really crank it up until 1921, and he was a well-known socialist leader before they pinned him with the F word. And we, the U.S. government, was putting the fasces, they call it the fasces, which is an axe head and a bundle of rods, on coins at least as early as 1915. It was also on the Mercury dime in 1916 and still is used. You'll see it when they show Congress. It's on both sides of the speaker up there. It's a little hard to recognize if you don't already know what it is, but there's two of them, one on each side, left and right, above the lectern, the podium area in Congress. And it's also on other seals and things. So not only did we have the stiff arm salute, which originated around 1892 with the Pledge of Allegiance, they had the robotic chanting to the flag, and they wanted to put a flag over every school. They wanted to socialize all the schools, which, as you can see, they were amazingly successful in that regard. And they're putting the fasces on the coins and government thing as a representation of the government. And then in 1921, Benito Mussolini picks up the fasces after it was already happening in the USA, and the stiff arm salute that had been going on for about three decades at that point in the USA, the stiff arm salute with robotic chanting, and as you mentioned, of course, the National Socialist German Workers Party, which is especially interesting because it was the National Socialist German Workers Party, and the Bellamy's had started the worldwide nationalism movement. Edwards' book was so popular, it was translated into every major language, including German and Italian. And it is startling how much American socialists had to do with spreading fascism worldwide and fascist symbolism, which all led to horrible mass slaughters all over the world.
I'll give you out that website address again. It's www.rexcurry.net, rexcurry.net. Lots of good information there on the origins of the Pledge of Allegiance and its relation to military socialism.
I'm also somewhat well known for pointing out how the National Socialist German Workers' Party used the swastika sometimes to represent overlapping S letters for socialism. They did that a lot with other similar symbolism, such as the SS division, and to this day you can see similar symbolism, alphabetic symbolism, on Volkswagens when you drive around the VW meshed. And also, before I forget, your listeners might like to watch Ron Paul on MSNBC, 8 p.m. He's in the debates. He's probably the only one worth watching. So that'll be fun to see how he compares. He very much supports the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. And the amazing thing about the swastika and the National Socialist German Workers' Party is that it was actually being used by Edward Bellamy's followers, especially in the Theosophical Society, which started in New York in 1875, even predating the Pledge of Allegiance.
Didn't know that.
The Theosophical Society with Madame Blavatsky, you can look that up on the internet. They used the swastika. And the unique thing about the swastika is that on her brooch, her personal symbol, it is not flat on its side, which was the more traditional method back then, way back. She had turned it 45 degrees to the horizontal and always pointed it, on her, at least on her brooch, in the S direction. So her use is more like what was adopted later by the National Socialist German Workers' Party, as opposed to the more common variations, which were they could point left, they could point, which would be the Z shape, they could point right, the S shape. They were often flat on one side as it was drawn within a square. Some people say that it was Adolf Hitler himself who decided that, by gosh, it was going to be turned 45 degrees. You can actually see a progression occur. There were examples of it being flat on one side. At some point, he decides it's going to be turned 45 degrees, and it's going to point in the S direction all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's also consistent with his SS division and, of course, all the other strange alphabetic symbolism that they were into. So
that's very interesting. I never knew the history of the Theosophical Society was related
it
to.
It gets even crazier. I could go on and on about that. Maybe we'll try to do a show on it sometime. But there is so much to say about how wacky the Theosophical Society was and how they inspired, promoted things that were repeated by the National Socialist German Workers' Party later. And Blavatsky started in New York in 1875, you know, 3 decades before the National Socialist German Workers' Party. They have bizarre...
Was she influenced at all by Edward Bellamy?
Yeah, oh yeah. What happens is she starts first. She's 1875. She starts to achieve some fame with her Theosophical Society, and she's already got her little brooch symbol going with the swastika. And Edward Bellamy writes his... He achieves fame in about 1888 with Looking Backward, which becomes an instantaneous international bestseller. She openly endorses his book and encourages their two groups to work together. And they did. A lot of Edward Bellamy's success really came from the Theosophical Society and her promotion of his book within the Theosophical Society. And so... That's how you get the connection between Edward Bellamy and the swastika. So it becomes a fascinating story, because not only can you make this connection between the origin of the stiff arm salute, later adopted by the National Socialist German Workers' Party through Francis Bellamy, Edward's cohort. They were both helping each other with their nationalism movement for socialism, though they called it military socialism. Then you can connect the swastika itself and its relationship to Edward Bellamy through the Theosophical Party that was actively promoting his book and his dogma of military socialism. And he was the cousin of Francis Bellamy. And then, as I mentioned a little earlier, you can see examples of how the government starts using the fasces itself, a different symbol. The axe head and the bundle of rods, which was also picked up by the socialist, longtime socialist Benito Mussolini. And of course, the word itself basically means stripes, band. It's related to the word fascia, fasciate. You could even, if you wanted to, you could say that the flag, the U.S. flag, is fasciate, because it has bands and stripes. The red and the whites are called fascia, and it's all related to the same word, the concept of banding, which in the case of the fasces is the bands around the bundle of rods around the axe head. And there was the German-American Bund, which translates as the German-American Band, and that was all related to Mussolini's group, the Fasci di Combattimento, which I don't speak Italian or German, but I try, which basically meant his band, his band of combat.
Yeah.
That was while he was still known as a socialist. He got the name El Duce while he was a socialist, well-known leader in socialism, before they started pinning him with the F word. So, yeah, it becomes terrifying, and it's also bizarre to read about the Theosophical Society. They are really strange back then. Oh, you want to know something else that's mind-boggling? To this day, Edward Bellamy's house in Chicopee, Massachusetts, is the home of the Theosophical Society.
And no.
I'm not kidding you. Look it up.
That's more than coincidence. That's more than coincidence now.
Well, they did work together.
Yeah.
From 1888 with his book. So, yeah, but it is amazing. It is still there. I'll tell you something else that's fascinating. The Rome Free Academy is where Francis Bellamy went to school as a kid. And if you look up the Rome Free Academy, their school seal, which is still visible on the internet, has two fascies on it. And I'd like to know when that was created, but so far I've not been able to find out when the school seal was created.
Is the school still around?
Oh, yeah.
I suppose you could contact them and just ask them.
Yeah, I've been pursuing that. So far, nobody knows. But, yeah, I will pursue that. I should try. It would be fascinating to know. I was amazed when I found out that Edward Bellamy's house is still the headquarters of the Theosophical Society.
I always thought they were kind of like just a bunch of philosophical eccentrics. I never knew a whole lot about them.
Exactly, yeah. Well, that's the common thread with a lot of the socialism is you can see it in so many civic groups, and including the Freemasons. You know, by the way, Francis Bellamy was a Freemason, and he used the group to spread his pledge in the salute.
Mm-hmm.
No kidding. As he did with lots of civic groups. You can't just say that it was, you know, crazy Freemasons or anything. But they used civic groups, as they did the Theosophical Society, to spread the idea of the Pledge of Allegiance, which at that time had the stiff arm salute.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, Freemason groups start their meetings with the Pledge of Allegiance. None of them know what we're talking about. And, of course, today they're doing it with the hand over the heart. They don't realize that they used to do it with a stiff arm salute, and that Francis Bellamy, the socialist, started it. So the point I'm making is, you're right, these civic groups, these social groups, are very vague about their philosophies.
Yeah.
And when you read what they say, like if you go to their web pages, such as the Freemasons or the Theosophical Society, it's all about altruism and volunteerism and brotherhood with man, which, it's just perfect if you want to be seduced by socialists, which is exactly what happens.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Well, the Freemasons actually go back to the, I believe, Middle Ages, later part of the Middle Ages, and they were definitely not a socialist organization in their origins.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read actually a number of my father was a Freemason. And I've read a number of quite a bit of their literature, and really, nothing like that exists in there.
Well, I hope that that's so with the old stuff. I know they go back way back, but anybody can pop on their websites right now, and I've done it. And you just read this. It's like any civic group anywhere. It's the same old vague, let's help everybody, world brotherhood, we like everybody, altruistic.
Yeah.
What do they do? They don't go around promoting the concept of private property rights or explaining free market economics. You get the impression they don't understand that as a concept worth talking about. Instead, it's what you usually get. And this is also true with religious groups, too.
Yeah.
It's just this vague, let's help everybody, altruistic thing that doesn't evince any understanding of private property rights, individual rights, or free market economics and supply and demand or anything else. So it ties right in with, unfortunately, socialism.
Yeah, I think as far as religious groups go, I don't know that there's so much a problem with property rights, but there's definitely, some of them definitely have a antipathy towards individual rights. I think we've seen that a number of places in the world, and even here in the United States, there are certain groups that really, even though they're very vocal when it comes to their own freedom of religion, but when it comes to the other part of the First Amendment, freedom of speech, boy, they don't like that, and they will threaten lawsuits and all kinds of nasty little things to thwart freedom of speech, and even truthful speech we're talking about.
I filed an amicus brief in the Newdow case, which is now in front of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, in which I explain all of this, at least as far as the stiff arm salute and the Pledge of Allegiance and its origins. So I'm helping to educate these people, and I hope I get another shot at educating the U.S. Supreme Court soon, because it seems to be headed in that direction.
Now, this is a case that's going to go before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Right. It's the same famous case years ago that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court with a fellow named Newdow out in California. Mm-hmm. And originally he lost on a technicality, which was lack of, I guess, jurisdiction due to, well, I won't go into details. But anyways, he just cured that problem, and he's relitigating the same topic, the issue, which is the Pledge of Allegiance. He only goes at it from a very limited way, which is attacking the two words under God in the mm-hmm. pledge. When I talk about it, you've noticed I don't talk about that at all. I talk about the whole pledge, and not only just the pledge, not only just its words, but the ritual, its origin, its mm-hmm. meaning from socialism, its original stiff arm salute, how it's performed in government schools required by law for mm-hmm. 12 years of every American child's life. You know, I go through the whole thing mm-hmm. and how offensive it is. And so that's what I do in my amicus brief to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and after that it's going to be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. So I try to educate everybody, and I certainly do appreciate your letting me chat with you here about the same topics and how the government just grows and grows and seems to get worse and worse.
Well, I think it's kind of like a snowball, and it's really a composite sort of thing. I think when we speak of government, we can speak of it more accurately, calling it composite government, because you have these different levels of government, a federal government being federal agencies, and you have state government and state agencies, and you have municipal government at the county level, and also when you have a city at the city level, and together as a composite, these entities can go pretty far in interfering with individual rights. And we're talking not only as far as economic, but we're also talking about, social rights. I guess you could call them social rights as well. And it's really tough for an individual by themselves to fight against this thing, to oppose it effectively. You really have to work with a group of people. It could be a lobbying group, or it could be a political party. And it's good to find a knowledgeable attorney to help you out when litigation looks like it could be imminent, or you just want you need some legal counsel to stay within the law. And we've been talking this hour with Rex Curry. He's a Tampa-based attorney, libertarian attorney who specializes in constitutional law and criminal defense. You can go to his website at www.rexcurry.net, and that's spelled R-E-X-C-U-R-R-Y. Rex, thank you for being on the Edge.
Thanks again, Tom. It was a lot of fun. I'll look forward to seeing you again soon.
I'm the producer and host of The Edge. I'm Tom Smith. We'll be back again next week with another interesting guest. Bye-bye.